The UK mistreated kids with gender dysphoria for years. I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust. And how the trans movement is erasing black women from history. Welcome to Fair News Weekly. To read all of the articles discussed in this podcast, please visit this podcast's episode description. For Fair's Substack, Fair Network attorney Daniel Craig wrote about the WPATH files and the impossibility of obtaining informed consent from youth. He writes, "The WPATH files are crucial evidence that proves youth gender-affirming care is the great medical atrocity of our time, on par with, or perhaps worse than, the 20th century's eugenics-motivated involuntary sterilization of those deemed inferior and the frontal orbital lobotomy. WPATH physicians have abdicated their responsibility to first do no harm. Sadly, we are once again reminded that well-meaning medical doctors are not immune from being swept up in the passion of a mass movement or being lured by the financial windfall from these expensive surgeries, consequently forsaking their sacred duty to practice ethical, scientific medicine. It is time for medical doctors who have lost their way to be held accountable." For the Free Press, Fair advisor Lisa Celine Davis wrote about the CAS report, a damning new report that reveals how a National Health Service failed to care for deeply distressed children with gender dysphoria in the UK. CAS notes that for most young people, Davis writes, a medical pathway will not be the best way to manage their gender-related distress. She supports expanding the treatment to regional holistic centers, essentially ending the specialist gender clinic model. That treatment should be based on unbiased psychological care, and robust and consistent evaluation tools must be developed so reliable evidence can finally be gathered. This final report, and an interim one CAS issued in 2022, echoes what a number of Western nations, such as Finland and Sweden, have found when they reviewed their own youth gender services. It also underscores what we see in the United States: poor quality research, an unstudied population, and detransitioners traumatized by the treatment they received. For the Free Press, Uri Berliner wrote about the ideological capture of NPR. For publishing his essay in the Free Press and appearing on its podcast, NPR had suspended Berliner for 5 days without pay. Its formal rebuke noted he had done work outside NPR without its permission, as is required, and shared proprietary information. And as of this morning, Uri Berliner resigned from his position at NPR. Berliner writes, "He declared that diversity on our staff and in our audience was the overriding mission, the North Star of the organization. Phrases like, that's part of the North Star, became part of meetings and more casual conversation. Race and identity became paramount in nearly every aspect of the workplace. Journalists were required to ask everyone we interviewed their race, gender, ethnicity, among other questions, and had to enter it in the centralized tracking system. They were given unconscious bias training sessions. A growing DEI staff offered regular meetings, imploring us to start talking about race. Monthly dialogues were offered for women of color and men of color. Non-binary people of color were included, too. All of this reflected a broader movement in the culture of people clustering together based on ideology or a characteristic of birth. If, as NPR's internal website suggested, the groups were simply a great way to meet like-minded colleagues and help new employees feel included, it would have been one thing. But the role and standing of affinity groups, including those outside NPR, were more than that. They became a priority for NPR's union, SAG-AFTRA, an item in collective bargaining. The current contract, in a section on DEI, requires NPR management to keep up to date with current language and style guidance from journalism affinity groups, and to inform employees if language differs from the diktats of those groups. In such a case, the dispute could go before the DEI Accountability Committee. In essence, this means the NPR union, of which I am a dues-paying member, has ensured that advocacy groups are given a seat at the table in determining the terms and vocabulary in our news coverage. Conflicts between workers and bosses, between labor and management, are common in workplaces. NPR has had its share. But what's notable is the extent to which people at every level of NPR have comfortably coalesced around the progressive worldview. And this, I believe, is the most damaging development at NPR, the absence of viewpoint diversity. For her Substack, Nevlin, Nevlyn Nagy sets the record straight about Pauli Murray, an iconic Black female civil rights activist who's recently been labeled as a queer non-binary ancestor. Nagy states, "These individuals and groups insisted upon speaking for and rebranding Murray, boldly proclaiming that her most inward feelings and personal struggles were truthfully those of a Black man, or otherwise, that they were unequivocally birthed from some ambiguously sexed non-binary Black person." In fact, Pauli Murray had always referred to herself as a Black woman, a Negro woman to be exact, with a capital N. And her experiences and understandings of her social positioning as a Negro woman are exactly what fueled her fierce advocacy work within the U.S. civil rights movement from the 1930s until her death in 1985. The whole point of her legacy is that she was such a powerful, dynamic force despite the odds stacked against her due to her race and her sex. The whole point is that she advocated for both racial equality and women's sex-based rights, for her own sake as well as for future generations. For The Federalist, FAIR-supported plaintiff Zach DePiero wrote about how AI obscures foundational skills of reading, writing, and thinking in a piece called "Artificial Intelligence in the Classroom Offers an Artificial Education." He writes, "Advocates of AI rightly argue that students can benefit from analyzing samples of the particular genre they're writing, from literature reviews to legal briefs, so they may use similar moves in their own work. This technique is called reading like a writer, and it's been a pedagogical strategy long before generative AI existed. Beyond pedagogical reasons for maintaining skepticism toward the wholesale adoption of generative AI in the classroom, there are also sociopolitical reasons. Recently, Google's new artificial intelligence program, Gemini, produced some concerning intelligence. Its image generator depicted the Founding Fathers, Vikings, and Nazis as non-white. In another instance, a user asked the technology to evaluate who negatively impacted society more, Elon Musk's tweeting of insensitive memes or Adolf Hitler's genocide of 6 million Jews. Google's Gemini program responded, "It's up to each individual to decide." If teachers insist on bringing generative AI into their classrooms, students must be given full license to interrogate its rhetorical, stylistic, and socio-political limitations. Left unchecked, generative AI risks becoming politically correct technology, masquerading as an objective program for language processing and data analysis. EDI and race ideologies in Canadian universities. Join Heterodox Academy and the Institute for Liberal Studies for the third annual Colloquia Conference on April 25th and 26th. This two-day conference explores the impacts, both positive and negative, of DEI and race ideologies on Canadian university campuses. Join Dissident Dialogues in partnership with Unheard and sponsored by Ground News in New York City on May 3rd and 4th. The world's leading and most original thinkers gather for 2 days of debate, discussion, and disagreement. Discussions will feature FAIR advisors Michael Schellenberger and Li Fang, as well as Richard Dawkins, Ayan Hirsi Ali, John McWhorter, Steven Pinker, Constantine Kissin, Francis Foster, John Barrickay, Thomas Chatterton Williams, Kathleen Stock, Freddie Sayers, Bridget Fedesi, Diana S. Fleischman, Africa Brooke, Alex O'Connor, and Mary Harrington. We want the FAIR Substack to be the go-to publication for diverse perspectives on culture and civil rights. Whether you're a seasoned author or an amateur writer with a story that can contribute to our mission of promoting fairness, understanding, and humanity, we would love to receive your stories, opinions, investigations, reviews, interviews, and more. Please send your piece to submissions at fairforall.org. We hope to hear from you. Finally, if you liked this podcast, subscribe, share it with a friend, and leave us a rating and review. Make sure to check out our newsletter and weekly roundup to read more into any of this week's stories, or visit the episode description. Donations are always welcome at fairforall.org/donate.